Coming up next is an encore presentation of Wednesday's Kenai Conversation. If you hear us asking for phone calls, just remember it's recorded, so don't call in. I'm Jay Barrett, and it is time for the Kenai Conversation. In the studio this morning, I have Ed Oberts. He is the board secretary of the Homer Electric Association and the incumbent from Soldotna. And Ed Schmidt, who is from Soldotna and is challenging Mr. Oberts for his seat on the board. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you guys doing today?
Real good.
I really appreciate you guys coming out here and talking to us about this. I hope we could fill an hour. I'm counting on you guys being loquacious.
Well, I'm sure your callers will have some really good questions. So.
Let's hope so. Well, let's learn a little bit about both of you. Mr. Schmidt, you were here first. Why don't you tell us a little about yourself, how you wound up to be in our town, and why you want to be on the Homer Electric Board of Directors?
I'm a retired surgeon and rancher from Colorado. As a little kid growing up, Alaska was always the promised land for me, and I couldn't wait to get here. But I decided that my surgery career and my ranching career took precedent. I bought the place that I live in the late 80s and never wanted to leave Alaska. I just love it up here. But anyhow, when I retired from surgery and the drought in Colorado essentially ended the ranching, I'd always wanted to build my own house, so I came up and built the house that I now live in. I've had many interesting careers throughout my life and many interesting board experiences, and I'd like to be on the HEA board to introduce some new energy to the HEA board. Power is something that's always been very intriguing to me, especially on my ranch when I had none, and I just want to see what new ideas I could bring to the board.
All right. Mr. Oberts, how about yourself? Tell us a little about yourself here, please.
Yeah, I was born in Soldotna, raised on my dad's homestead out in Sterling. My dad was Mike Oberts, and then my uncle Leo Oberts was well known here for Kenai for his insurance company and real estate businesses and things over the years. I've been interested in the HEA board for years and years. I was just trying to remember when I first ran. I think it was 25, 26 years ago I ran for the board. Our daughter had just been born. And part of the reason why dates back to those early homestead days when I can remember as a kid watching the evening news or the show right after the news on the TV and would see the TV go snowflakes, you know, all go out, and you could count the seconds. You had about 3 to 5 seconds to think, okay, where is the flashlight? You know, because we knew the power was going out, and it always did. And in Sterling, it was always a 2.5 hour to 4 hour reset for the power to come back on. And we just grew up that way. It wasn't a big thing, but it's one of the reasons why I chose to run then and choose to run again here now, is that reliability of power, how much it's changed over the years, and I've just got a fascination with energy too, so it's a good fit for myself.
Excellent. You know, speaking of fascination with energy, I have nothing against middle-aged white men, being one myself. But the board is full, completely full, of middle-aged white men. What do you think draws people like us, I guess, to this sort of board of directors? Mr. Oberts, why don't you
it kind of goes back to, you know, there are people out there that are interested, but it's a hard hurdle to get elected. You know, I ran in 25, 26 years ago. And I can remember sitting there at the apartment, putting labels on a mailer and trying to get elected, but it's hard because people are kind of set in their ways. The number of people that vote is pretty limited. You know, the incumbent usually wins. There's just a lot of reasons why. You know, I'd love to see some younger people get on the board, some women get on the board. We've had them in the past, and they've been very effective board members. The other part of it is you have to have the flexibility to commit to at least one day a month for board meetings. And realistically, historically for me, it's at least 2 to 2.5 days. At some point, there'll be a work session or something that as a board member, you should try to attend. So you have to have that flexibility, which lends itself to being retired or semi-retired. Myself, I'm not retired, but I sell real estate. I'm self-employed. I have a lot of flexibility, so usually I can make those meetings.
Oh, sure. Mr. Schmidt, what do you think of the makeup of the board, and and do you think diversity would be worthwhile at some point?
I think diversity is always a good idea. Getting new ideas and getting fresh ideas and a different point of view is always worthwhile to help you think creatively about things. I do wonder, though, about the people that are attracted to energy, the nuts and bolts of it, how much things cost, how much it costs per foot to run a power line. Those kind of details remind me of, you know, studying medicine, where you really can get bogged down in a lot of details, and it's critical to your understanding of the issues. And maybe that only appeals to some of us who have strange ideas of what fun is.
Well, what are some of the, let's take off from that, what are some of the details that you envision working, you know, 1 to 3 days a week or a month as a board member?
The first thing that comes to mind is all the possibilities for new sources of energy and for inexpensive ways to use renewables for electric generation. I think the world is changing so fast right now, and things that I never dreamed I would hear about, I'm hearing about. Like this morning in West Texas, it cost natural gas producers $3.38 a cubic or 1,000 cubic feet to get rid of their natural gas. There is such a backlog in the pipelines that they have to pay to get rid of natural gas. All my life, natural gas has been so precious that it commanded an enormous price. That little detail is something that just blows my mind, how different it is in different parts of the world, especially since we pay 7.71 cents for that same unit of natural gas up here in the Cook Inlet. Those kind of details are just fascinating to me.
Turn my microphone on. Mr. Roberts, what about you? What do you? You've been on the board here three terms, it looks like. What's next if you get reelected again?
Well, it'll be continuing some of the things that I've enjoyed being part of on the board. You know, when I got elected, HEA was facing a deadline to self-generate our own power. We had already, a prior board had already sent Chugach Electric a termination notice. We were no longer going to, really pay them, because it was a take-or-pay contract, and we always paid. We never took the minimum, so we always were paying them extra money for years and years and years. And two things changed. One, that contract changed, but a few years prior to that, the legacy gas contracts were a big issue that expired. You know, for years and years around here on the rail belt in general, natural gas was a freebie. I mean, it really was. And Marathon Oil and others had found these giant gas fields and signed contracts that were ungodly low priced, and for 20 years out in the future, because there was just so much gas in the area. But it was culture shock for all of us, including myself, when those legacy contracts expired. So we've looked a lot toward efficiency. When we went with self-generation, we had a 40-megawatt gas-fired turbine in Nikiski that we added a steam turbine to that created more energy with no more use of natural gas. Now, we do have an option of using our duct-fired burners and generating additional power, but we picked up substantial efficiency. We brought jobs to the peninsula. We did a lot of really positive things on the efficiency side. You know, the other thing that we've been working toward is more hydropower. Hydro really is the greatest bang for the buck, even though it's very, very expensive. Hydro in Alaska basically works as a battery. So it's there when you need it. If you don't need it, you can store that energy. You can use it when there's a peak demand or when a turbine goes offline. So there's a lot of flexibility there, and I'm really supportive of hydro. We've got the Grant Lake project we're working on. We got the Battle Creek diversion going into Bradley Lake that HEA has been fortunate enough to pick up additional shares of. So we have some really neat things in the future.
Let me ask you about hydro. I recall, I can't remember what year it is, but a little bit of controversy about the damage dams do to salmon and salmon streams and anadromous streams. Is that not an issue right now? Are we kind of free and clear as far as anadromous streams and dams?
You know, the Bradley Lake is a prime example. Bradley Creek does not produce any salmon. So it's actually been a very, very good project, not only for the state of Alaska, which owns the project, but actually for the fishery too, because the very lowest stretches do have some habitat in them. And with the dam there, we've been able to maintain flow year-round in that creek. And the same thing will happen at Grand Lake. Even though the power plant will be above the stretch where most of the fish are, we'll maintain water year-round in that creek. We'll have a lot more flexibility. So I don't see a downside in those cases. I mean, you have to be careful, but they've been researched. And Bradley Lake is one of the shining examples. You know, it was the highest cost power on the rail belt when it was built, but now it's the lowest cost, and we're getting close to having the bonds paid off. And, you know, it's got another 50 to 70 years, 100 years of production. You know, it's just a great project. I've gotten to tour it several times. It's very impressive.
Could I comment
Please.
On that?
Because yes.
I'm not so certain that Bradley Creek doesn't produce salmon. I think it really does. And I think that there are certainly sections that, if the dam and power plant were done even better, could enhance those salmon spawning areas. I think that there's some controversy around that, and I've talked with the project manager about that in some detail, not as much as I'd like to. I also would like to point out that Cooper Creek was a king salmon spawning stream that was dewatered by the hydro plant. And a lot of us can't remember that. Yeah, that did produce a lot of king salmon. And so at what point do we say we need to protect our salmon?
Mm-hmm. What do you think about other renewable energy resources? We don't have a lot of wind here, maybe up in the Turnagain Arm side, but, you know, we get, I guess, as much sunshine as anywhere in the state.
Yes, I was just at Peggy Mullen's solar rooftop tour last weekend, and that was fascinating to me because I hadn't realized how inexpensive the panels had gotten and how efficient they are and how quickly that will pay back the average homeowner if they put rooftop solar on their houses here in Alaska. It's based on our rates, which currently HEA has some of the highest rates in the rail belt. And because of that, roughly 23, 24 cents a kilowatt hour, it makes rooftop solar very, very, very efficient. The other thing I will say is I was at the first U.S. wind energy conference. It was in Colorado Springs around 2003. At that time, Colorado Springs Utility and Xcel Energy, which was the big energy company in Colorado, were totally against it. At that conference, I learned that they know exactly how long those turbines will last. They know exactly how much power they'll produce. And they sold the power to the utilities at wholesale rates. And they could generate then a sheet to show that this was economically viable. My ranch had 11 miles of a transmission line through it. So there are two things with power. You have to produce it, and then you have to send it somewhere. We have some issues with that here in Alaska that HEA cannot send their power north now because of some disputes with the transmission. But at any rate, at the ranch, because I had the transmission line, I had people jumping up and down saying they would lend me $250 million for wind turbines. I'm an avid rock climber. I didn't dream that some of my friends could make a good living servicing these wind towers because they're so giant tall. I think one I just read about was 300 feet tall. My point is, this is changing unbelievably quickly. Berkshire Hathaway Energy has gone from very little wind power in Iowa to committing to 100% wind power at a cost of 6.2 cents a kilowatt hour, one of the lowest in the country. So I laugh at myself when I try to think of solar or wind. I really don't know much about it because it's changing so quickly. What is uneconomical and unfeasible now, by tomorrow, might be. The hydropower, there's some interesting people doing a lot of interesting research. We've even partnered with HEA has with a plant near the Forelands to look at whether or not we could get hydro or tidal power. That could be a real good thing. I don't think it's there yet. But again, I could wake up tomorrow and read an article that says, yeah, we need to do that. So I guess my point is, one of the things in my ranching schools was the boogeyman's in the gas tank. You spend a lot of money driving around burning fuel. That money just goes away. If you can invest in something that's going to keep returning forever, like tidal, like solar, like wind, when it makes sense, that's the thing we need to jump on as soon as it's available.
Oh, excellent. I want to give out the phone number again, 283-8414, if you have some questions for the candidates for District 2 of the Homer Electric Association Board of Directors election, Soldotna, Sterling, Kisilov areas. We have Ed Oberts and Ed Schmidt both here in the studio. Mr. Oberts, let me ask you about renewables beyond what you mentioned about Bradley Lake. I understand HEA is starting to look at solar down near Anchor Point or something. What else? Please maybe address the topic.
Sure. Yeah, maybe I can just start with a little discussion on the types of power out there. One of the real problems with wind and solar is it's not firm power. There's in the electrical industry, especially on the generation side, there's firm and non-firm power, and there's also spin. And they all kind of interrelate. You know, firm power is you turn on the switch, you turn on a big electric motor, and you got everything works. Unfirm power is it may or may not work. Maybe the wind's blowing, maybe the sun's blowing. And then there's another part of that is integration. If you go with non-firm power, wind or solar, you got to integrate it onto the grid. And that becomes somewhat of an issue. Even right now, we see Chugach Electric, we see the variables at Bradley Lake at the east end of Homer, of Ketchumak Bay, being run up and down to follow the wind. Now, Chugach is probably using all of their hydro resources to try to follow Fire Island wind. And unfortunately, these turbines were built a long time ago, and they aren't set up to adjust that fast. So they overshoot, and they start to oscillate. Now, that can be remedied with a new turbine or, you know, more things on the rail belt. Battery technology, one of those new exciting things, even on an industrial scale or a transmission scale, is slowly becoming a possibility. You know, it's easy to assume that it may come quicker than we realize. So there's a lot of neat things on the horizon. HEA did look at putting a solar project down in Anchor Point. The unfortunate thing, the way the RFP was worded and everything, it came back that it would be more expensive power. And the unfortunate thing, it ramped up over time. And it was also set that the independent power producer, which would install everything, would just pay us a flat fee. One of the problems with solar, you know, my own Redot Realty, we've got 48 panels installed on the roof, and it's a cost to do that, but there's also the potential payback. But as private owners, private individuals, you know, it's real easy to look at those panels and then look at your phone and go, oh, I'm making power today. This is great. I personally would like to get HEA to the point where if we do a solar project or a wind project or an alternative energy project, that at least the members that choose to get involved have that same excitement when the sun's shining, that they're making power. The way it was structured, there wasn't really going to be that opportunity. So I really do see there's opportunities in the future, either wind or solar or some other renewable. We are doing landfill gas at the landfill. We're trying to do that in working with the borough. So
really,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah. They're not really under regulatory pressure, but eventually they will be to capture their natural gas or their gas that's produced. It's not clean gas. So it'll probably be a reciprocating engine that we use to generate a 2-megawatt little plant there. But they also need the heat to evaporate some of their water. They have too much water there, at least the last few years when it's been raining as much as it has been. So that's kind of a neat little project because we have another, NSTAR's got a pipeline there so we can get gas if we need additional gas. And we have two transmission lines. We may or may not hook up to them, but they're both within about a half mile of the landfill.
Wow, that's super interesting. Let me get the phone number out again, 283-8414, if you would like to call in with questions about power and electricity and your home or electric board of directors. Please do, 283-8414. Operators are standing by. You know, a week or two ago, California Light and Power, or Electric and Gas, or whatever it's called, the big utility in California, admitted that they probably started the Camp Fire, the largest wildfire in California, and probably five others over the last X number of years. We have a lot of trees around here and a lot of power lines. Are our members, are us as members protected, from that sort of catastrophe that might, cause HEA to, get in a lot of legal exposure and, get passed on to consumers? How are we doing as far as wildfire prevention?
I was in a board meeting in Homer and somebody saw smoke, and this was a couple of years ago. And immediately we called our attorney that has a staff person that's very knowledgeable on emergency situations because of that liability. We didn't know whether it was associated directly with ours. I don't think it was. I think there was a car accident that caused the power line to go down that started the fire. But liability to today's world is a big issue. And we can't, HEA can't insure our distribution lines. We can insure our generators and our big, big expensive equipment, but we can't insure those little things. So, we do have some liability policies that would kick in, but nobody wants that to happen. And what we've done is pretty proactively done a line clearing process. People don't like us coming into the neighborhoods or our contractor, Carlos Trees, to come in and cut their shrubbery and stuff out. But it's really the best thing we can do to protect ourselves is have a strong policy that will come in and remove the trees from under the lines.
Mm-hmm. Could I? Yes.
I remember one of the neatest demonstrations I saw. There was the summer picnics in Soldotna Park, and I think the IBEW guys were showing holding a tree next to a power line. And my whole family and I were amazed at how quickly that started on fire. And so I can really appreciate that trees next to power lines can be a big problem. But I'll also throw out that in Colorado Springs, all the power lines are underground. The Colorado Springs utilities just decided that rather than put up telephone poles and the power lines and fiddle with those always going out, they just bury them because they last forever. There might be places where burying lines might make a whole lot more sense. I certainly don't know that. But again, from going to a place where you'd never saw power lines above ground to where they are above ground and can catch on fire, just makes me ask some interesting questions.
Mm-hmm. Let me, Ed.
Well, if I could add to that.
Sure.
Yeah, HEA is, our rates to extend power are the same for overhead or underground. We encourage underground for those reasons, but underground still has its issues too. I mean, just recently, I think last week down in Homer, there was an outage that affected an area, and HEA was able to get the majority of the people back on within hours, but 40 members were out overnight because it was an underground problem, and to find it and dig it up, splice it, repair it, they were out for an additional 4 or 5 hours. So, I personally have seen, I think of a house out in Sterling in the Kenai Keys. It was lived in year-round, but the HEA maintains the power line from our poles all the way to the meter base, wherever that is. And on an older home, a lot of times it's back on the house. Well, the frosted jack heaved and pulled that line out of the meter. Well, then HE's on the hook to fix that. So they ran a temporary line from the neighbor over the tree and had to come back. And, of course, the guy had just paved his driveway. You know, there are costs to have an underground, too.
Oh, excellent. Mr. Schmidt, we hear Mr. Oberts, talking about these different aspects of Homer Electric board membership, a wide variety of different things that need to be grasped and understood. Did you have, I know you're a surgeon and a rancher, which is really super interesting, which I'd love to talk to you more about, especially in Colorado. But do you have other board kind of experience, working with eight other folks and debating these sort of things down? And
I do. One of the boards that I'm most passionate about, I'm on the Saltesche Trails Board. And we'll have a meeting later tonight. But just to see how a group of citizens got together and identified a need for ski trails in the community, and then in a way that didn't cost the borough anything, built the Saltesche Trails Association into what it is today. That's a work in progress. We keep experimenting with things. We keep building new trails, trying to decide how many to build, what's good, what's bad, who should use them, when, how, the user conflict. There are all kinds of just fascinating things at the board level. But the Saltesche Trails are just a jewel of what goes on here in Soldotna, I think, and around the state. I've worked in physician boards with insurance companies, surgical center boards. I had my own surgery center in Colorado Springs, where, again, you're looking at what do we need to provide? How do we do this? How do we minimize problems? How do we do it most cost-effectively? How do we just get this job done? And I think with the electric board, I mean, it's the same problem since electricity was generated. It started that people would have their own power plants in their houses to power their house, and then multiple people around the city would have them. Those would expand to a couple of blocks. Pretty soon we decided it's best to have some sort of centralized power and then a good way to distribute it. And I think in Alaska, that's what we're doing right now. You look at all the power generated in Alaska, it's relatively small compared to any city in the U.S. I think we have a lot of issues because we're so spread out. How do we distribute that power? And we're currently trying to decide what is a fair way to utilize all these power lines that we've got up. How do we standardize them? How do we allow somebody to get a contract to send power through those? Can HEA send their power north, or does somebody up there have some say in it and they don't want us interfering with their power generation? We need to resolve those sorts of issues for the benefit of everybody who turns on the switch to get power. Electricity is sort of like water, but it's not. If an electron has a way to get somewhere, it goes at the speed of light. It doesn't care how long the path is. It could go from here to Fairbanks just as easily as from here to the bathroom next door. We have to think of it in those kind of terms. And so how do we generate power as cheaply and efficiently as possible? And then how do we distribute it as cheaply, safely, and as efficiently as possible? Those would be the sorts of problems I'd be looking at from a board level.
Mm-hmm. You know, everybody who runs for anything, and not casting aspersions here, I read Mr. Che's board statement as well, and he says, well, inexpensive, reliable power. I would ask, though, Monday our power costs went up by 0.7 of a penny. It seems to be the wrong direction. Are we ever going to see cheaper power? What do you think, Mr. Oberts? Let's go here.
Sure, I'll answer that. It's kind of an unfortunate event, several events all occurred at one time. We had Halibut Cove, our line serving Halibut Cove, basically wash away. So we had to send generators over on a barge to Halibut Cove and backfeed on the best we could, which means moving diesel and keeping those things running this summer. Hopefully it's finished now, but that we finally got our permits and we're able to go in and replace the poles and everything permanently here. Hopefully permanently. I never know what Mother Nature will throw at you, but that was a huge expense. And we, unlike some wind events, if a wind event on the Kenai Peninsula gets up there where we're having $1 million or more in expenditures, we've been lucky enough to always get FEMA funding. Sometimes it's 2.5 years later, but we get funding for at least a portion of that disaster. In this case, we had in 1 month an $800,000 loss for HEA, which was kind of a shocker. Another factor in there goes to the transmission, the Wheeling disputes on the rail belt. Wheeling's what's called to let those electrons flow over your distribution or your transmission line. And HEA hasn't received any financial contribution to our cost to maintain those lines in years now. And we've been working with the rail belt. We're headed toward trying to form a Transco, which is a independent company made up of a for-profit company and hopefully all the rail belt utilities to all agree to fund the total cost to expand the transmission lines where it's economic and feasible, and then have a postage rate stamp kind of cost to move power from here to Fairbanks or from Fairbanks south. That's one of the concerns we hear repeatedly at the board, that some of the larger independent power producers want to see, because it'll allow them to get onto the transmission line and they'll know what their costs are.
Oh, sure. Mr. Schmidt, you don't have any current experience on the board there, but let me ask you this. Can one person make a difference on a board of 9 people, if you're elected? This probably goes back to the question a minute ago about working with others, but can one person make much of a difference?
I think it can. It's a hard to define way, but I've seen it on multiple boards, where collectively the desire to cooperate, admit what the problems are, and face them builds an energy that all kinds of good creative solutions can come about. That's why I say I would like to try to add some new energy to the board to get some fresh blood, some new solutions to these things. I am distressed that our rates are as high as they are and going up. I think in today's world, there might be some options that we could do things that would change that. And a board that can work together cooperatively can really make a big difference in ways that just are not obvious from each individual. It is that some is greater than each individual part.
Mm-hmm. A minute ago, I was pointed out that our rates went up 7/10 of a cent. The other thing, though, is sort of the opposite. I'm going to ask about something that would probably cost the association more money. I get my bill in the mail, and I can't remember exactly what it was on there, but I found that the bills come out of like New Jersey or someplace back east. Wouldn't a great job for co-op members be working for the co-op here on the peninsula? Mr. Roberts?
Yeah, that decision way predates my time on the board, although we have brought it up like at least 3 times I can remember and had a discussion about it. And part of it historically was HEA had a carpal tunnel claim. And years ago, technology was not where it is today, admittedly. And it was a much more manual process to open and process all of those payments. We do use a co-op out of Georgia to process our bills. It's the same co-op that maintains our accounting system, software-wise and so forth. So it's a good integration there. They also maintain our, at least our financial side of our website. so there's some synergies there. And being a co-op, they also provide us capital credits back too. So they I think have, well, I'm not sure how many, they have like 80 different co-ops across the country that's all they do is process their bills. So they've got economies of scale and so forth to really do things. And every time we've looked at it, the numbers just didn't make sense to hire somebody here locally or two people to process bills. And that's where we've been. I mean, we've had lively discussions on it.
Yeah. Would it just be two people? I mean, are we contracting this out to Georgia for the want of two employees?
Well, it's the cost of that plus the equipment to print the bills and the envelopes and everything and to process that. And again, technology's really changed over the years. You know, envelope stuffers are much cheaper than they used to be, so it's probably something we should reevaluate again and take a look at.
Yeah, sure. Mr. Schmidt, what do you think?
Again, you never know where you're going to find one of those miraculous things that says, oh my gosh, this is so much easier and simpler and saves us a pile of money. Again, running my surgery centers, you'd be surprised in medicine how many obvious things, once somebody presents you with the answer, become obvious. You save a lot of time, money, and become much more efficient. And I delight in finding those sorts of things. And so if I think with some curiosity and hearing a good question like you just raised, I bet we could come up with a local solution.
Yeah, kind of a follow-up. HEA does give an opportunity for you to choose to have an electronic bill sent to you. It looks identical. It's just emailed to you, or a link's emailed to you to log in and see your account. And probably that's where the potential savings really is we need to simplify that process, make it easier, encourage our members to go electronic and save a few trees along the way and postage. All those things that there probably are more opportunities there. I personally have signed up years ago, and I've gotten used to it, but we don't promote it the way I think we should.
Yeah, my bill is paid automatically online, but I still get the paper bill, and I should probably go online this afternoon and change that.
Yeah.
As soon as I get off the air. Our phone number, 283-8414. If you'd like to call in, we have about 20 minutes to talk about electricity. And with our two candidates here for board seat District 2, we have Ed Oberts and Ed Schmidt, both of Soldotna. It is the Kenai Conversation. We've got about 15 minutes here, and we're talking with two of the candidates for Homer Electric Association Board of Directors. These two are for District 2. Ed Oberts, the board secretary of Soldotna, is a three-time incumbent, is that correct? Yeah. And Ed Schmidt of Soldotna, who is a retired surgeon, who is seeking his first term on the board. Let me ask you this, Mr. Schmidt. What is it about Ed Oberts you want to see off the board?
I don't want to see Ed off the board. I like Ed. He's a great guy. I just want to bring some fresh energy. He's been on the board three times. I think that board turnover is actually a good thing. I've seen it in other boards where you think we've got a great functioning board, but you change up the mix a little bit, bring in some new ideas, and good things happen. And that's all that I'm saying is I want to give people a choice and maybe bring some fresh energy to the board.
Sure.
I like Ed real well. Don't agree.
I don't want to leave our listeners with the impression that that you don't.
And I don't have any objection to anybody running against me. I mean, I've run and lost, and that's fine. And HEA does have term limits. You can only serve three consecutive terms. The only reason I'm allowed to run at this point is 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I lost and sat out a year and ran again. At that time, Dave Carey, who'd been on the board 20-plus years at that prior times, just had gotten off as borough mayor and chose to run, and he beat me, and then I got elected the next year. So I'll be term limited out if I get elected this year, and if not, I'll probably be back next year. So.
What about board service on the HEA board is so attractive to you that you'd come back after Dave Carey beats you?
It's just one of those things. I've always had an interest in it. You know, I over the years, I worked for the the borough mayor, Dale Bagley, for 6 years and looked at budgets and studied budgets. And in my opinion, the biggest, most important thing that, a board of director does at a nonprofit the size of HEA at a $101 million budget is to approve that budget. A lot of things go into that, you know, what are your operations, what are your plans and goals and all those things. But I just get fascinated about that stuff, and I enjoy doing it. So
the HEA budget is $101 million?
It is, it is. And that's because we've grown over the years. You know, we operate from Saldovia to Nikiski to Sterling. And then we've taken on self-generation, too, so we generate our own power, which is a lot of times a whole separate company, and even HEA's got it set up under a separate co-op for financing purposes only. It's the same 9 members that operate both co-ops, but we got better financing terms by separating it off, so we've taken advantage of that over the years.
How much has that budget grown? How steady is that?
Well, it has grown over the years, no doubt about that. But since we went independent light, I think it was $98 million, and then it's increased a couple million, $1.5 million a year. Some of that is due to inflation, wage increases, so forth. That's probably the primary thing. You know, we talked about rates, and I really do think we're right on that cusp. You know, I did vote for this last rate increase reluctantly. I voted against the prior one that was submitted 3 months before that. But we're really at the cusp. The one downside to our budget is we don't know what we're going to sell for power. You know, we're taking our best guess at what the next 12 months is going to be when we do the budget. And we've had milder winters, you know, very few people are plugging in their vehicles anymore. That was a big revenue source to Homer Electric. So, you know, some of that, the conservation everybody's doing is forcing us to raise rates. But I think we're at that cusp where we can adjust for that. And if conservation and technology improvements just stay at 1 or 2% a year out into the future, you know, we're seeing growth in the area. We're seeing new meters being installed. So I just think our rates are pretty stable and could almost go down. You know, we have some opportunities in the future here. So I don't know whether we'll lower rates immediately or we'll invest that money into Grant Lake, Battle Creek, some of these things that are coming on the horizon.
A specific example I just heard about again this morning that's real exciting to me is the potential for plugging in electric cars. If we could get that stabilized and dependable and the rates reasonable, it may be that the electric car is something that would work even here in Alaska. When you think about how gasoline cars worked, it was a really big deal first to produce the gasoline car and then to get gas stations everywhere. They didn't just spring up. That had to be planned and organized. I think one of the problems with electric vehicles now is if I'm driving to Anchorage, where in the world am I going to recharge that thing? If we could do something similar, because we want to sell the electricity that we're going to produce more cost effectively, I hope, and if one of our problems is we're not selling enough electricity, if we were to come up with a good way to commit to being able to charge electric vehicles, which are much more efficient to operate than gas vehicles these days, that could be a game changer. Again, I don't know that we're there, but when we are there, we need to be the first to jump on board that train.
Does Homer Electric have an obligation to, in your minds, and maybe in real life, I don't know, to embrace a new technology? It does always seem to be more efficient, but there's also a lot more of it. You know, what's the balance there,
Mr. Roberts? It is a balancing act. Homer Electric did purchase an electric vehicle. We've had hybrids in the past, and they didn't turn out quite what was anticipated. So, yeah, we have some, maybe not obligation, but some community relations, community support, and you know, opportunities out there. And the board has had lots of discussions about how do we increase our sales. And the electric car is probably the best example. It has a lot of potential. And the other utilities on the rail belt all see it too. So we're all kind of working toward charging stations and encouraging more and trying to get some grant money to help put in charging stations along the whole rail belt. So it would hopefully reduce a lot of that range anxiety where you're driving to Anchorage and you almost make it, but you don't.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd talk to that. Again, the new energy, the new ideas. Believe it or not, the biggest thing I did as a surgeon was introduce the idea that if you poked little holes in people to do an operation, they did better than if you cut them wide open. Now, I think any fourth grader could say, that's a good idea. But what it took was for me being aware that some French surgeons had come up with this new technique to poke little holes in the belly and take out gallbladders, and then to work with a few American surgeons around the country to say, oh, not only is that an idea, we can do it. It's cheaper, it's better, it is great. But it takes looking to see who's doing this right, where they're doing it right, how that fits in here. I would not go say, let's buy an electric car generating station right now. I would want to see somebody that's done it right, proves that it makes money, and that everybody's happy, and then say, I want to be the second guy to do that, not the first.
Mm-hmm. Is there a spot, Mr. Overs, you're talking about the, when you're talking about the price increase and the problems over in Halibut Cove, and the need to raise rates to make up for those expenditures for that emergency there. What's the breakdown of things that cost money and require a rate increase, or things that the association, you know, pays for out of savings or over time or something?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what your question is. The rates, you know, we have to generate, at least ideally, we want to generate a margin or a profit at the end of the year. Being a nonprofit, we don't want to have an exorbitant amount in any profits or margins we have. We eventually roll back through capital credits to the members.
Yeah. But does every expenditure require a rate increase, or at least thinking of a rate increase?
No, a lot of expenditures are capital expenditures, and if we replace a pole that's broken in half, that's a capital expense, and it's amortized or depreciated over a 15 or 30 year process, so it doesn't hit our books all at one time. We still have to be able to have the borrowing capacity, so we have to make sure our equity ratio is high enough that our lender will lend us money, which it is. That's really what, you know, what drives rates is, at the end of the day, is your financial statements, those key equity ratios, a couple of other ratios that the lenders look at and the regulatory commission looks at, and that's what drives rates.
How big is the savings account at HEA these days?
We really don't have much in savings. We have an operating amount. You know, the bank at any given day will have $4 million to $14 million, depending on what's coming through. Because we manage our money fairly well, our financial department does. Our lender, CFC, is a co-op. It gives us a line of credit, so we can draw on that line of credit. We try not to have a whole lot in the bank, per se. We've also taken advantage of some opportunities to put some money toward future payments on our capital expenditures that's earning us like 5.5%. Now they're starting to limit us on that. So we do have a few million set aside toward future payments, but it's earning more than what the underlying loan is at. So it's a good place to stick cash. Yeah, we don't have a big fund balance. You know, this about 60% of everything HEA owns is financed in one portion or another. And that seems to be a good way to look at it. 40% is equity, member-owned. And that can be a member that's 30 years old. It's money that those margins have accumulated over time. And then the other 60% we borrow.
Okay. You know, we are just about out of time here. Perhaps I can have you guys maybe sum up your candidacy or your appeal to the voters of District 2. Mr. Schmidt, maybe we'll start with you.
I think it's pretty simple. I just want to give people a choice for some new ideas, some new energy on the board.
All right. Mr. Roberts?
Yeah, like I said, I'm excited to be up for election, and hopefully we'll be, with your support, be reelected. You know, I've been in the area, I was born here in Soldotna, and I was the president of the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank when it first did its nonprofit paperwork. I was on the CES board. I served 6 years for the borough mayor. I've worked down in the legislature one session. I think I have a lot of expertise that just is a natural fit for this, and that's why I've kept running over the years and enjoyed my 9 years on the board.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you both very much for coming in today. Ed Oberts, the board secretary and incumbent for District 2, and Ed Schmidt of Soldotna, retired surgeon, who is also running for the District 2 seat.